Hello and welcome to the Unbundled Attorney Mastermind Podcast. My name is Dave Ahrens and I'm the co-founder and CEO of Unbundled Attorney. In this podcast, we interview many of our provider attorneys, as well as some of the leading experts in the industry to isolate the best practices for building internet-generated leads and how to ethically and effectively offer unbundled legal services and other more affordable options in your practice. For more information about our services, visit www.unbundledattorney.com. All right, today's show is an interview I had with Charles Skinner, who's been one of our provider attorneys for a long time now, at least a couple of years, and was originally working out of El Paso, Texas, but has recently made a transition from El Paso to Dallas and now serves a couple of counties just outside of the city of Dallas. And that's where we focus a lot of discussion in this episode is how he's been able to make that move. You know, from number one, closing down his practice. And as a result of, you know, his wife, the reason he moved was his wife got a job in Dallas. He hasn't had much time to make this transition. And as a result, has moved to Dallas and has had to go back and forth between the two cities, El Paso and Dallas, in order to make this transition and to continue to close up and address all the clients that he had in El Paso. And so, you know, we also talk about some things that have involved him having to go back and forth, like the air miles programs that he's been working in and how he's built up that a huge amount of air miles as a result and how to work that system. But, you know, how to wrap up a practice and also how to start a practice from scratch in an entirely new city. And he gives a lot of practical suggestions as he's going through it right now on how to get to know the judge, the local rules, and really get acclimated to a new environment. And at the same time, we also talked about a lot of other practical strategies, such as, you know, for example, being creative with the way you work with your clients, not only with the options that you offer, unbundled and payment plans and so forth, but also with the ways in which you accept payments. And he gives some examples of how he's bartered with clients in the sense that, you know, if they didn't have cash on hand, they have, you know, he's acquired guns from clients. He's had clients perform services for him, such as, you know, he's going to tell a great story about how he built a structure in a zoo as part of payment for his services. So there's a lot of, you know, out of the box examples of thinking through how not only can he work with people more affordably, but also give people more options than just cash to pay him. So really a unique and interesting episode, tons of things to learn from. So let's get right into it. This interview with Charles Skinner, one of our provider attorneys now out of Dallas, Texas. All right, Charles, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dave. Thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah, you know, really looking forward to this, Charles. You know, it's been quite an evolution over the, a couple years we've been working together. I mean, even since back in the early days. So, you know, and you've made some transitions during that period. So we're looking forward to exploring this relationship we've had over this long period of time and how it's evolved. And so I thank you again for taking the time to share the story and what's been working well for you.
I'm really glad to be here with you. A little bit about my practice and a little bit about me just to start off with. I'm actually not originally just an attorney. I actually was a third generation machinist for 10 years. Before I went to law school. So it's given me a little bit of a different perspective on practicing law than most of my colleagues who just went directly from college to law school and never were out doing something else before they became lawyers. So I've actually had a couple of different careers before I went into law. I was a machinist for 10 years. My father was a machinist. My grandfather was a tool and die guy. Who actually owned the factory that I worked at for 10 years. And I started at the bottom. You know, basically my father was real big about saying, listen, if you're not in the right seat on the bus, you don't belong here at the business. So, you know, they brought me in and I learned basically everything you could learn from a machining standpoint first. Before I went into quality control and then doing contracts and then doing sales and then doing all sorts of other things before I went to law school. And it gave me a certain amount of perspective, for lack of a better word, as to how things should run and how to do things efficiently across the board. After I left the machining business, though, I actually went and got a financial advisor's license before I went to law school as well. So I have the efficiency side of it from a business review, the financial side of it from a financial and estate planning, And then I went to law school and learned all of the other fun stuff that they teach us between criminal law, family law, estate planning, and just the general things that you have to deal with day to day.
Right. That's really interesting. And so maybe can you share, you mentioned, you know, how it's given you a broader perspective. You know, I think you were alluding to how you understand how a business works and from an efficiency standpoint. So maybe you can expand a little bit on how that experience helped you with, you know, running a firm and so forth. And also if it, you know, helped better understand your clients a little better, because a lot of the people that you're working with are, you know, working families, working folks, you know, that have, you know, working a specific job. You might even talk to some machinists, you know. So can you share a little bit more about how that perspective and that experience working as a machinist and then all the way up in the ranks informs your practice today?
Well, from an efficiency standpoint, you have to learn. It's given me a perspective to look at it and say, okay, what is going to be the most straightforward route from point A to point B, which is going to have the least waste in it and the most, for lack of a better word, profit potential? Because you're looking at it to say, okay, what's the minimum number of steps I have to get from, let's say, a divorce, from the filing to that final hearing where my clients are going to basically have their case closed out and finally have that divorce in hand that they're chomping at the bit to get. And sometimes it means you have to have a tough conversation with a client to say, okay, here's the skinny on this. You can get what you want. I think I can win if you tell me what you want, but it's going to cost you 10 times what you're going to be able to afford in order to do it. And sometimes being able to work those numbers and talk to your client very, very frankly to say, listen, yeah, I think you've got a good case here. The question is, do you have enough money to fight it? And being able to figure out where all of those points are that are going to be expensive to them. I mean, here in Texas, we require pretty well the filing up front. And usually that takes a couple of hours to write. Then you have the filing fees, which vary $260 to $380, depending on which county you're in. Then you have the service of process fees. That's another $100 to $125, depending on where they're going. Then you've got the initial appearance in front of the judge for temporary orders. That can go anywhere from 45 minutes to 4 hours, depending on what they're fighting about and if there's children, if there's property. Then you've got discovery, which even in a small case can take 4 or 5 hours. In a big case where you've got, you know, a lot of property or a lot of different property, can take 25, 30, 40, 50 hours of the shot, depending on who you're representing. Then here, pretty much all of the counties require that you go to some form of separate mediation or alternative dispute resolution because of the state legislature having pretty much mandated it. So that takes between 4 and 8 hours. If you have one that's where the parties are real contentious, but you think you might be able to do it, it might go 12, might go 16. And then if you can't come to an agreement in the mediation, or you can't come to an agreement on everything, then you have your trial setting at the very end, which might go 4 hours, might go 2 days, might go a week, depending on how long it goes. So it really behooves you to be able to look at the case that you're getting up front to say, okay, here's what I think it's going to cost, and have that frank discussion with your client to say, this is my best guess based on what you've told me, but it could be less or it could be more, depending on the decisions that the client wants to make in the meantime. Now, from an efficiency standpoint, it lets you set certain mile markers in the case to say, okay, we're at discovery. What do you really want to know? What's important to you to know, and what can be just kind of ignored because you're not going to be fighting about it? If one party says, yeah, I don't think I'm the appropriate party to raise the kids because I'm on the road 48 weeks out of the year, that's not a big deal. That means you say, okay, we're going to make you the possessory conservator. You can pick your weekend that you're going to be doing your possession and access, but you got to give the other party notice. However, if you got two parties that are going to want to fight about who has the kids in their possession, then you're going to have a bigger issue because you may have a home study, you may have some sort of psychological or psychiatric examination, of both parties and children. You might have a domestic relations office report that's involved, and all these things start adding up, and you need to have a real good feel for where those funds are going to come from and how much your clients can afford to pay outside of you, not just your fees in representing them, but all of these other tertiary subcontractors that need to be dealt with. So that's from the efficiency standpoint to look at, to be able to go, okay, have mile markers to say, this is where we are, and make sure you're real aware of your client's finances and how much money they can bring to bear on the suit to begin with, because that's going to inform the decisions that you make in order to make it efficient for them long term.
Right.
And what was the second thing you asked me? You asked me to elaborate on something else.
Well, yeah. So you've got that business acumen that comes from, okay, how do we make this as efficient as possible, least amount of steps involved, you know, to make it straight line, so it's interoperable and streamlined. And then the second thing is, you know, obviously being a machinist and being out in the world working, you know, I don't want to say a real job, but just, you know, a standard blue collar position, as opposed to just going straight into law school and then becoming a lawyer, you know, gives you a unique perspective, I think, from understanding the working class and being able to communicate from a standpoint of knowing the situation they're in from a financial perspective, knowing what it's like to live check to check and being able to communicate on that level. So that was the other piece there.
It really has. I mean, there's a certain amount of rapport building that you have to do with each client. But I found that having a blue-collar background actually has served me very well. It's actually, strangely enough, served me well with a lot of other attorneys, because a lot of them have told me, oh, yeah, my father was a machinist. My mother was, for some of the greatest generation people, it's like, my mother was a riveter in World War II. My mother, you know, did bomb building for mortars for the army when they went over into Vietnam or when they went into Korea. You run into those sorts of people. It's also given me a certain perspective of being able to talk to some of the people who come in the office, because they come in and they think, well, wait a minute, this guy is an attorney. He's the big, powerful person who, he's not going to listen to me. He's not going to talk to me. And maybe this is a slightly different perspective than probably most of your listeners are going to have. I do it all myself. I don't have a staff. I don't have an assistant. I don't have a legal assistant. I don't even have a secretary. I practice what one of my professors lovingly called law out of my back pocket. My clients have my cell phone number. If something goes wrong, they can call me pretty well 24/7. And I will largely pick up. The only time I don't is if I'm out generally to dinner with my family, because I have a wife and a 3-year-old now. But for the most part, if you know the number of clients that I have, if something goes wrong, I want to know about it as soon as possible, because that lets me make decisions as to what will serve my clients best, whether I need to file a motion to enforce a possession and access schedule and have it drop 8 a.m. the Monday after a weekend, or if one of the parties gets into a domestic dispute with the other party. Great story. One of the ones that I'm in the process of doing is a divorce right now, which actually came from Unbundled's attorney. Captain in the U.S. military, married to a Greek Cypriot in El Paso, basically was attacked by the Greek Cypriot and with a knife, and he fled the house, called me up, and he said, what do I do? And I said, you're going to come in, you're going to park your butt in my chair, we're going to sit for 4 hours, we're going to draft a protective order right now. He's like, really? We can do that? And I said, yes, come now. Don't stop. Drive directly to my office. Come now. We'll have it written before you walk out my door. And he did. He came in, we sat in, we did it, and he had a protective order 3 days later, which honestly gave him possession of the kids, possession of the house, and kicked the wife out to the curb until she did anger management classes. But it's that sort of thing which, you know, you may have your clients, they're not always the most sophisticated people in the world, but if you can talk to them on their level, it makes them comfortable and they are more likely to open up to you. the better they open up to you, the more information you're going to get, the better decisions you can make. And also, you know, as you mentioned, you know, having that paycheck to paycheck perspective sometimes means that you're willing to look at things that you otherwise wouldn't. And here's a good example of that one. I'm in the process of doing a suit affecting the parent-child relationship in Kaufman County, which is one of the new counties I took on. I originally started in El Paso, closed my practice there because my wife took a new job in Dallas, and moved my, you know, closed my El Paso practice, and I'm opening a practice in Ellis County and Kaufman County, south of Dallas. One of the clients that came in needed a suit affecting the parent-child relationship answer. They had been served by the other party, who was the mother of the child, and the father came in and said, the hearing is set for the day after tomorrow. What do I do? I said, well, you need to file an answer. Okay, can that be done in that period of time? Yes. What's it going to cost me? Well, my best guess is probably between $2,500 and $3,000 from the get-go, that for the whole thing, but it kind of depends on how much she wants to fight about it. He said, I don't have a way to come up with that. I've got a whole bunch of things to sell that I'm in the process of trying to sell. I'm trying to sell a storage, basically a boxcar storage container. You know, I'm trying to sell a motorcycle. I'm trying to sell a car. And then he said, well, I'm also trying to sell some firearms. At that particular time, I happened to be in the market looking for a pistol and a rifle. I said, well, what have you got? He said, well, I've got an AR-7 and I've got a Cobra of Utah semi-automatic pistol. Said, okay, let's take a look at them and see what they're valued at. And we did. And this particular client actually paid me initially $280 in cash and two firearms, basically for the cost of his initial representation.
Yeah, you know,
so
Pardon me? Continue your point there. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. I guess the advice I would have to the listeners is be flexible in what you might consider as payment. Don't turn your nose up when a client who's cash poor might be willing to barter. Now, here's the other thing. That particular client, I was willing to extend a certain amount of credit to because his parents walked in with him with the paid off deed to their house and was willing to hand me that as collateral. Right. And I said, no, I'm like, that's a bad plan. I told him, listen, you've got that, hold on to it. I'm willing, you know, we'll talk about a payment plan because I know you're good for it. Because people don't just walk in with a paid off deed and to a $100,000 house and say, we want you to take this as collateral for paying us. I said, let's not do that. That's a bit much in terms of what I think this representation is going to be worth. But we'll take a look at it as we go along. But I mean, that may be the thing. You may have a client who's willing to come in and give you let you hold on to a deed for a car. Let you hold on to a deed for a house, let you hold on to a deed for a business or stock or bonds or some other, you know, form of collateral. So I guess this is the thing. Don't, as family law practitioners, we sometimes turn our nose up at the fact that, well, that's transactional practice. It's something else outside of what our normal wheelhouse is. And it really doesn't make sense to do that when a client may be able to come in and be, like I said, cash poor, but asset rich. They may have something that they just can't convert into cash quickly, but they're willing to put up as collateral. And I know for some of the family law practitioners, it'll be reaching all the way back to law school, but remember your secured transactions and your mortgages and deeds of trust work, because sometimes that may become important for making it available for a client to be able to pay you long term, or depending on what the client has, being able to pay you short term as a barter transaction rather than just straight cash.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we talk about in the podcast, you know, helping attorneys come up with more creative, you know, more affordable options for, you know, serving more clients, and you know that, you know, bartering hasn't come up yet on the podcast, and so I'm surprised because, you know, that's what a lot of people have is. You know, I've got a good friend of mine and his father is a construction worker and has built tons of houses. And the guy has more tools than God. I mean, the guy has so many tools And anytime he gets an extra dime, he's buying another tool. And so, you know, these are things that, you know, depending on what you do and so forth, but they have value. And maybe you could you give maybe a couple other examples of different clients that you've, you know, bartered with and different types of things you've accepted, whether it be gold or silver or anything else that you've been able, or things that you've held as collateral for a payment plan to find a way to work with someone that maybe doesn't have the cash right now, but has some things that they can secure it with.
Well, here's one. It's not one of the family ones, but here's actually one. I have a very, very small corporate practice where I represent a couple of very small family corporations. One of them actually happens to be a builder. And I've done hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of work for this company. I mean, it's one of my staple companies in the background. But at one point, he was very, very cash poor. I mean, he was just running right up to the margins. He had nothing to pay me. And he said, "Can I build you something?" And I said to him, "Let me think about it." Now, at that time, I mentioned my wife took a different job here from Dallas. She was working for the zoo in El Paso. And it was, I happened to be reasonably civic minded. And I said, "Okay, what does the zoo need in terms of something that can be built for the zoo?" And basically, my wife said, "The Africa division needs an employee bathroom on the backside of the zoo." I said, "Okay, let's take a look and see what that's going to do and what that's going to cost." This particular builder came in, gave us a proposal. We sat down, we worked it out, $50,000 proposal, took it to the city governing council, got it approved as a donation to the city zoo for him to build it on site in exchange for basically a donation gift from me. So it will show up in the El Paso Zoo as being a building gifted by my law practice to the city of El Paso for the benefit of the zoo in exchange for the work I did for my client, representing him in before a whole bunch of different contractors and a whole bunch of different lawsuits that, you know, some were valid and some were just spurious. But what it did was, it was a public relations benefit because I got to go in. I have a proclamation basically thanking me for a donation to the zoo from my law practice on behalf of the city of El Paso. You know, I got a real nice picture. I got, you know, was put in the zoo newsletter with the blueprints to the building, the picture of me, my wife, and my son. We used it as a bit of basically free advertising because it's not something that people normally do. People don't just, you know, normally give a building to a city function.
Right.
So it's one of those things that doesn't come up very often, but, you know, got me interviewed by the press. It got me interviewed by the paper. It got me, you know, there's a proclamation basically on file forever in the city. So if anyone looks me up in relation to the city of El Paso, it pops up. Oh, Law Office of Charles Wesley Skinner donated a building to the zoo. Okay. You know, it brings people in the door and they go, "Are you the one who donated the building to the zoo?" Yes, I am.
Yes, I am. Yes.
Yes, I am. There's the letter thanking me for it on the wall.
That is so awesome. And now that you're in Kaufman County in Dallas, I mean, do you still get a call here and there of people like, "Hey, yeah, I saw your, you know, your advertisement on the zoo, and I need some family law assistance"?
Every so often, yeah, I do. I mean, that's the thing. I'm still actually sometimes getting calls from El Paso for people saying, "Hey, I need family law assistance," and largely I've given them other individuals to call. Which I know Graham has asked me a couple of times, who can I recommend in El Paso to take over the unbundled attorney? And unfortunately, none of them have the capability to take it on directly. So it's more of a referral as things come up sort of deal. But, you know, people will call up and say, "Oh yeah, I saw that your law office donated the building. What was that all about?" It's kind of a nice icebreaker to be able to talk to people about and say, "Well, it was X, Y, and Z, and I do a little bit of extra work, or I do other work than family law."
Yeah.
And I guess let me talk about that for a minute as well. a lot of lawyers that I've spoken to who do family law are, for lack of a better word, myopic. They just focus on the family law. They focus on the divorce. They focus on the suit affecting the parent-child relationship. They focus on the adoption. They focus on change of child support. I think that's a mistake from a law practitioner standpoint. And part of it is the law school I went to, and part of it is the teachers that I had. I had a fantastic professor who taught contracts, mortgages, secured transactions, equity, estate and future interest planning, and what was the last one? Oh, and he was the advisor to the medical law journal on campus. Now, what he taught us is to take a holistic approach to law, always. The client who may be coming in may say, I need a divorce. Okay, well, tell me about your assets. I have a construction business. I have a car. I have a truck. I have, you know, three kids. I have a grown child from another marriage who occasionally gets into a little bit of trouble. Okay, guess what? You don't just need a family law attorney. You need someone who can look at the criminal thing from the other child. You need someone who can understand and evaluate what's going on in the business to determine whether or not they're properly leveraged, whether or not they need to do their own secured transactions. They need to do some sort of pledge or some sort of debt service. Do they have any sort of contract disputes with their clients? Do they have any sort of contract disputes with their subcontractors? Are they, as I said, properly leveraged, and are they paying their taxes, their fees, their things with the city and county governments and the state government? Are they an LLC? Are they a C corp? Are they a sole proprietorship? Are they a partnership? And sometimes you ask your clients these questions and their eyes kind of glaze over a little bit and they go, is that really important? And you go, yes. The answer to those questions, the question, is that important, is almost always yes.
Yes.
Because you need to understand what is going on in your client's life to be able to give them the proper advice regarding what they're asking you to do. And, you know, the great example of that is one of my other corporate clients has a trucking business. He got into a business relationship with his nephew and his nephew's wife about 10 years ago, came into my office because he needed some family law done for his will. But as we were digging into it, found out that the nephew's wife was embezzling from the company. And that created a whole new set of issues that we had to deal with, from basically saving the company from her malfeasance. Now, it's one of those things where you hate to see it, but he would never have found out if he hadn't told me, this is what I'm doing and this is what I want to happen to the assets that are involved.
Right.
So it you know, be willing to look at that criminal case that your client may have. Be willing to look at the estate planning. Now, you may need a specialist to do it. You may need to say, okay, I can't do this myself. I need to have somebody come in as a third party and either give me advice how to do it, or how, you know, determine how to split a fee based on what that new piece of information is.
Or open up relationships with attorneys that do specialize in that area of law, and now you have a reciprocal referral relationship.
Right. Great example of that is my new office in Waxahachie, Texas, which is, like I said, just south of Dallas. The building that I'm in, the other two attorneys that are in that building don't do any family law. They don't do any criminal law. They don't do any estate planning. They just do business transactional law. And they were thrilled the day I walked in the door and said, I do criminal, I do family, and I do CPS law. They said, huzzah, we can finally refer someone, because they get walk-in traffic all the time because the courthouse is literally right across the street. Where do I find a criminal attorney? Where do I find a family law attorney? I've been served with a divorce. Where do I go talk to somebody? Before they just said, yeah, we're sorry, we don't do that. Now it's walk down the hall, speak to Mr. Skinner. You know, make an appointment. He will be more than happy to assist you.
Yep.
And for their own clients who occasionally get into criminal issues or get into family law issues, they'll be able to say, hey, you know, yeah, we don't do that, but we have this guy down the hallway. I guess that also opens up another topic to talk about is it does make sense to make a whole lot of relationships with other professionals. In the building that I'm moving into, I have the two other attorneys who do the transactional practice. We're trying to get a CPA to move in, and we're getting a contracting firm that deals with basically building, but a different type of builder. It's basically a home builder rather than just a general contractor. Now, it makes sense if you can start to develop relationships, because eventually you're going to need one of those people. You're going to need somebody to explain the finer points of accounting. I happen to have a concentration in tax law from when I went to law school. I don't use it. And largely I got it because I wanted to be able to look at what my clients were doing and know whether or not I needed a specialist. And it's come up before. I've basically looked at things and gone, yeah, we need a CPA to look at this, because while I understand what's going on, I don't understand it well enough to be able to explain it to a jury. And this is going to come up in front of a jury when we do this divorce, because they're going to want to know how to divide these assets and what's fair based on the valuation of the assets versus the valuation of the company.
Right. So this has been really good. So, I mean, and just to summarize, I mean, so when you're looking at creative ways, and I think we should talk a little bit more about some of the options you offer, but as far as the services and the ways you kind of you break up, you know, how you serve your clients, but certainly the points you're making about, you know, it's not just necessarily cash. You've got, you know, services the client could provide. I mean, I know of an attorney that used, you know, that had one of their clients cleaning their office. I mean, there's creative ways to look at services, possessions, you know, assets, collateral. And, you know, it's not about, you know, taking people's stuff. I mean, it's really just about figuring out, okay, well, we need to help this person accomplish this goal. It's going to cost a certain amount of money to get it done. You know, there's a lot of creative ways we can work within the budget of the client by offering payment plans and unbundled, limited scope, breaking things up task by task, offering payment plans, and everything we can do within the structure of the way you work with the client on the actual case. But there's also a lot of creativity around, you know, helping the client realize ways in which they can pay you to do the things that they want you to do. And I think that's a really valid point. It's something that I think a lot of attorneys don't necessarily think about or look at, is how they can start to figure out taking that person from step A to step B, you know, not just in adapting their practice, but also ways in which they can help the client you know, finance that, you know, beyond just the cash. So that was really, really helpful to share that. Can you talk a little bit more about the legal aspects of ways in which you work with clients, you know, either from, you know, the retainer, or if you've done payment plans, or if you've done unbundled options, and what's that look like up till now from the way you've structured the options you offer?
Okay, sure. Here's pretty much the way I structure what I need to do. And it somewhat depends on what the client wants to do. There are some clients who come into my office who say, I just need something written, and I just want, you know, I want somebody to write it for me because I'm not good at writing. Those are the clients who are usually fast representations in terms of not actually appearing, but just drafting a document, something like a suit affecting the parent-child relationship, asking for a modification of their child support. It's going to be basically they need documents so that they can get in front of the judge, tell the judge, hey, I'm making X rather than Y. I need to adjust my child support. There are some that say, okay, we've got a pretty decent agreement as to what we want to do for a divorce, but we want somebody to draft it for us. And those you have to be real careful about. That's, I think, the 12th commandment of attorneys: thou shalt not represent adverse parties in a proceeding. So you have to be real clear with your client to say, okay, husband, I'm representing you. And the wife is sitting right there. You turn to the wife and say, wife, you have to understand, I represent him. I'm giving him advice as to what is in his best interest. You need to understand that, and you need to understand if you want to proceed, you're proceeding by yourself without an attorney. And you make sure that, you know, you put that right in your letter of representation that says, I represent husband, I am not representing wife, even though she may be present for some negotiations, she may be present for some speeches, she may be present even at, for mediation by herself, or she may be present at some settlement conference, but I am representing husband, and the husband understands and agrees that I am only representing him in this action.
Right.
And then if the parties can't agree to that, you say, okay, listen, I'm not going to represent either of you. I will write a document, but I will not sign it. It's not my place to sign it because I'm not actually entering a representation. I'm literally just writing the document between the two of you, and I'm not giving you any legal advice as to how that happens.
And have there been times when you've worked as an objective third party where you're mediating the two, or you typically do that in your practice?
I don't do that in my law practice. I actually have a mediation practice separate from my law practice. So strangely enough, I have done that, but not as a lawyer. I've done it as a mediator because I have my certificate to do mediation and arbitration in Texas. So, and that's one of the reasons why I pay attention to it, especially when the clients come in and say, well, we've agreed on everything. You know, I say, okay, which one of you is going to be my client? And usually they give me an odd look and I go, listen, I can't represent both of you. I need to represent one of you. Which one's it going to be? Because the other one, I'm going to say, okay, let me go talk. Let's say I'm representing the husband. I'm going to go talk to the husband out in the hallway for 15 minutes and get the real rundown on what's going on and ask the hard questions. Have you determined what you're going to do with the kids? Have you determined what you're going to do with the house? Is there any property? Is there any real property? Is there any retirement accounts? And if they tell me, you know what? There's no house. There's no cars. There's no jewelry. We've divided everything. It's already in separate houses. We just want the divorce. At that point, then I'll be happy to go, yeah, I'll draft it. You know, because there's literally no assets. And I will be happy to say to them, I will draft this. It will not be that expensive because literally we're going to draft it right here and now. We're going to draft the petition. We're going to draft the decree. You guys have agreed on everything. You know, basically, here's your divorce petition. Go file it. 60 days later, take this in front of the judge and say, I want a divorce. They'll ask you, has it been 60 days? You say, yes. Have you divided your property? Yes. Are there any kids? No. You're divorced. Poof. You're done. And largely, those are the ones that walk out of my office with all the documents in hand and have paid me $600-800 for my afternoon, and that's it. And I never see them again because they've dealt with everything they need to do. Now, sometimes you come in and you have that conversation. You take the husband out in the hallway and you go, okay, is there a house? No. Is there a car that you've purchased during the marriage? Yes. When was it purchased? Well, it was purchased about a year ago. How much is owed on it? Well, there's some debt on it. Okay. What are you going to do with it? Well, we haven't really talked about it. Okay. There's an issue. That's got to be addressed. Are there kids? Yes. Who's going to get them? I am. Okay. We're going to ask her about that when we walk in. And sometimes you walk in and Teal has said, I want them. And she sits down and say, she wants them. And now you've got a contested divorce. At which point you go, okay, you need to understand I represent him. You've now raised a contested issue. It is in your interest to go talk to a lawyer. You need to go talk to somebody else. And, you know, sometimes in El Paso, what was nice was, there were five family attorneys in my building that were all solo practitioners. I could sometimes go to the office next door, knock on my next door neighbor's office and say, Claudio, I've got somebody in my office that needs an attorney short term because they want to do a divorce. They said it was agreed. It's not agreed anymore because there's an issue. If we're going to continue with any sort of negotiations today, she needs somebody to represent her. At least today, to make sure she doesn't get into any sort of trouble. If you want to work out a fee with her, that's between you and her. And sometimes that turned into something. You know, they do. You know, my next door neighbor would pick up $200 because I had two parties walk into my door And, you know, I'd end up with a client. He'd end up with $200 in his pocket for doing a fast back of the envelope representation right then and there while they worked out terms. And if they could work out terms, great. If they couldn't work out terms, then it became a contested divorce and, you know, other things came up. Now, in terms of what I do for billing, the straightforward stuff is just cash on demand. If they're walking out with a document, I expect them to pay for it right then and there. If there it's going to be a longer term representation, Texas largely requires you to do what's called an interest on lawyer's trust account. It's effectively a holding vehicle for client monies. And the way you deal with it is you say to the client, okay, I expect this is going to cost $4,000 total. I'm willing to take payment plans for the second half, but I want half up front. The client says, okay, do you accept credit cards? Yes. And then I have to accept them through Square. So I have a little credit card reader that I just plug into my phone and they, you know, swipe it and deal with that. If client says, well, I want to make out a check, who do I make it out to? I say, okay, you make it out to Law Office of Charles Wesley Skinner, IOLTA. They say, what's that stand for? Stands for Interest on Lawyers Trust Account. Basically, what happens is you pay me a check. It goes into a separate account. It's not part of my law practice. It is an entirely separate holding vehicle for monies that clients pay me that I have not yet earned. I then bill against that amount that they've put in and send them an invoice every month. So let's say a client puts up $2,000. Day one, they spend $600 because we're drafting the documents together. And then it costs $100 for the service of process and $15 for the citation. And then there is a temporary orders hearing a month later because the other party files like a short general denial answer. You bill that $600 up front, the service process fee, the citation fee, and the 1 hour appearance later on, and let's call that at $250 an hour. $650, $700, $800, $900, $1,015. What I do is I go to my bank, I take $1,015 out of my IOLTA account and put it in my law practice account, make a notation in my billing software that says this client has now paid me $1,015.00 out of the $2,000 that they've put up front, and then send them an invoice for the $1,015 so that they bring the interest on lawyer's trust account from the $985 of that back up to the $2,000. As you proceed through the representation, you bill and then you send them an invoice to replenish the fee. And then the last piece of the representation you do, either whether that be trial, whether that be an agreed order, whether that be the parties reconciling and saying, hey, yeah, we don't want to get divorced, actually. We decided we want to live together. You say, okay, here's my final bill. You bill out whatever that final bill is, and the client gets back anything that's left over. So let's say you end up with $600 left over at the end of the representation that you haven't earned. You actually send the client back a check for that $600 to say, this is the extra money that you paid me in advance as a prepaid evergreen fee that I have not earned. Here's it back. And I've had to explain this to a whole bunch of clients, and almost to a one, they are flabbergasted that they're not just paying a flat fee. And I've had to tell clients, I don't do flat fee. Well, I have done flat fee three times. One time it burned me badly, one time it worked out okay, and one time it broke even. Because invariably, the clients fail to tell you something. And I've just said to them, listen, there's something coming up that I'm sure you're not telling me. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it may mean. It may mean nothing, it may mean something. But my standard practice is just, this is my hourly rate, you're paying for my time. The more you call and the more I have to handhold, the more it's going to cost. If you got your act together and I don't have to handhold you and you're not calling me every other week for an hour, this is going to be pretty straightforward. But if you need a lot of handholding, you need a lot of reassurance, this gets more expensive. And that is a discussion that most attorneys fail to have with their clients and end up getting high maintenance clients that they haven't properly billed for or properly set up.
Yeah.
Because then they're having to deal with, you know, great example. One of my divorce clients in El Paso right now is a retired super heavy truck driver who's disabled. But he's real upset with his soon-to-be ex-wife because she basically sent a whole bunch of money to the Philippines to buy a piece of property there that he didn't know about. Between the two of them, they have a house, a couple of cars, and some assets. But he's real upset about this piece of property that she's buying in the Philippines that he never knew anything about. And she's basically shunted the better part of probably $25,000 to in the last year and a half, 2 years. So he's constantly going through the documents saying, well, you know, I want to bring up this piece of property in the Philippines. I want to bring up this, I want to do this in the divorce. And about once a week, he wants to talk about it for the better part of 20 minutes. I've had to tell him, you know, you're burning money. Every time you talk to me about this, when I've told you we're already going to deal with it in the divorce, we're going to ask questions about it, we're going to follow up on it, we're going to do discovery on it. But because of his personality, he wants to talk about it. And I've told him, you're burning cash every time you do this, every time you want to bring it up. But he's okay with that. He wants to bring it up because he wants to talk about it. And he needs to feel heard about that particular piece of evidence.
Yeah, so, I'm sure everyone listening, every attorney listening has been like, yep, we've got clients like that. Yep.
Yep. Well, that's the advantage of billing hourly. Because I send him an invoice every month. This is how much time you spent on the phone with me. These are the topics we talked about on these telephone calls. These are the days you called. These are the times you called. And I bill them in 1/10 of an hour increments. So every 6 minutes, because he's an El Paso client, I'm charging him $200 an hour. Every 6 minutes costs him $20. So if he wants to talk about this, you know, the house in the Philippines that the ex-wife is buying for 20 minutes every phone call, that's $80 right there for right. Something that is of no benefit to him, but is emotionally satisfying to him because that's what he needs to talk about to get it off his chest.
Right. I'd like to, if it's okay, I'd like to switch gears a little bit. You mentioned El Paso, and you know earlier on in the interview, the podcast episode, you talked about how you made the transition from El Paso to you know Kaufman and Ellis County. Can you just talk about you know how you made that? You know, a lot of attorneys feel like you know I've got this big practice in this one city, and they kind of feel rooted down to that city because that's their living, that's their livelihood. Can you talk about how you made that transition, what you had to do to wind down that practice? And obviously, you know, you were able to come back on board with us and get leads right away. So maybe that was helpful for you, but maybe you can talk about how that transition was for you and what was, and what you learned from it to do it effectively and efficiently, as you talked about earlier.
There's going to be some cases that you're going to have, which are just going to be dogs and are going to follow you no matter where you go. When my wife decided to take the job in Dallas, I had 178 cases open in El Paso between my criminal practice, my family practice, my corporate practice, and my child protective services representation of children. That was 6 months ago. In that time, I've closed 135 cases. You know, the criminal cases, basically I went and looked at and said, okay, which one of these are cases which are going to resolve themselves with pleas? Which one of these are cases that are going to resolve themselves by plea bargains or by being dismissed? Which one of these can I ethically lean on my clients to accept some sort of pretrial diversion? And which one of these are going to trial? And I put them into nice, neat piles to say, these are the ones I can reasonably say are going to be plea bargains. These are the ones that are going to be trials. These are the ones that are going to be PTD. And then I had a small pile left over where I didn't know what was going to happen with those. So I took all the ones that I knew were going to do one thing or the other and scheduled them out as quickly as possible. Same thing with the family law cases. I took a look at the ones that said, okay, These are ones that are going to resolve themselves because the parties are actually able to talk to each other. We're going to get to a deal. These are the ones that are not going to get to a deal because the parties can never talk to each other and they're constantly fighting with each other. They're constantly withholding the children from each other. This one just has to be a trial and the third party has to make the decision as to what these two are going to get. Put it, then you have your third pile of, these are the ones that I don't know what's going to happen with or that I can no longer reach my client. Those ones, basically what you do is you try to reach your client, you send them a certified letter. If they don't respond, you file a motion to withdraw and you just get out of the way. You say, you bill it out and you sit the money in your interest on lawyer's trust account and do the best you can with trying to get it back to them. And sometimes some of the money I've been sitting on for a while. Same thing with some of my other cases that I do just on the side. There's some of them that have paid me who basically I've called up and said, I'm moving to Dallas. I'm sorry. You're going to need to find another attorney. Here's all your files. Here's all your documents. Here's where we are procedurally. I need you to make a decision on what you want to do. Either you're going to work with me and we're going to settle this, or else you're not going to work with me and I'm going to withdraw and I will give you a list of attorneys' names for you to go contact to either basically file in a entry of appearance or to file in a motion to substitute because I'm getting out. And those are the ones who you tell, listen, I'm just getting out of the way. I can't take this on because I don't live here anymore. The Child Protective Services cases have been the hardest ones to get rid of, strangely enough, because I thought all of them were going to resolve themselves in a reasonable period of time, and strangely, just weird things have happened in them to keep three of them on. And I've went and spoke to the judge and said, Your Honor, what do you want me to do? And she said, you don't live here anymore? No. File a motion to withdraw. I will grant it. You will be out of the case. Just submit your final bill and off you go. I said, thank you, Your Honor. So from the standpoint of that, I have 36 cases left that I'm still tying up. 12 of them are divorces, and all of them are going to trial. I have 4 suits affecting the parent-child relationship that are in different stages of being done. Those are going to tie themselves up in one form or another. They're all going to be agreements. It's just a matter of hammering out the details. I have the 3 CPS cases because I just did that, or I just spoke to the judge last week. She said, file your motions to withdraw. I said, Your Honor, thank you. The criminal cases that I have left are all going to be pretrial diversions. It just is what it is. I've spoken to the clients. I've spoken to the district attorney. They said, yeah, we're going to do this. We're just not willing to do it yet. I said, should I have someone else come in? They're like, no, we give you our word. We will do this. We'll put a note in the system that you have access to and that all the other defense attorneys have access to that says you're getting X, Y, and Z. Just basically give us a call in another month and we'll do it because it'll be after the Christmas season. We want to see if your clients can behave through Christmas and New Year's. In terms of opening a new practice, between unbundled attorneys and passing me family law leads and some of the judges here in Ellis County and Kaufman County being willing to give me criminal appointments as soon as I get an office, getting a new office open has not been as painful as I expected it to be. Now, as I said, this has taken me 6 months to get this done, which means I have spent an enormous amount of money on flying back and forth because I've been flying from Dallas Love Field to El Paso generally every other week for the better part of 6 months now, which has been tough on the wallet, but great for my number of frequent flyer miles.
Right.
Well, here's the thing. I have earned 120,000 airline miles since August. You know, it behooves you to take a look at which airlines fly where, because I've been flying Southwest back and forth. Southwest has this great program for A-list and A-list preferred flyers where if you fly over a certain number of miles, or you earn a certain number of airline miles in a certain period of time, you get certain benefits. As soon as I knew I was going to do this, I applied for a Southwest credit card with airline miles as a benefit. Just signing up got me 50,000 airline miles. On top of that, the 120,000 I've earned from flying back and forth, from buying the ticket, you know, one way is about 3,000 airline miles, plus I'm putting it on my Southwest airline miles credit card, so that's another 750 airline miles. Plus, whenever I have to rent a car, that goes on there, that's extra airline miles. Plus, I'm running all of my filings through the credit card. So basically, anytime I need to file a document, 100, 200, 300 airline miles at a shot. Once you get over a certain threshold, you get what's called A-list membership, which means you get certain benefits, you get preferred business upgrades. When you get a certain, I think it's like 35 or 40,000 airline miles past that, you get what's called a companion pass, which means for the calendar year you're in, plus the next calendar year, you can designate an individual to fly with you for free anytime you travel.
Right. I've heard about that.
So, yeah. So for Southwest purposes, I have a three-year-old. He needs to have his own adult ticket to travel with me. Anytime I travel, he can travel with me for free for all of this, for the rest of this year and all of next year.
Right.
If I earn 6,000 more airline miles between now and December 31st, I qualify for what's called A-list preferred status, which means I get double airline miles. You know, basically I get a free, what's called flyby pass, which allows me to, for airports that offer it, basically it means I don't have to go through the normal security line anymore. It's kind of like pre-check for TSA, but it's a separate line, basically, that you bypass all of the waiting that people normally have to do at the metal detectors and the millimeter scanners now. Basically, they have a separate one at certain airports you can just go through.
I mean, looking back on it, Charles, obviously you made the move because your wife got a new job in Dallas. But if you were to, you know, if that didn't happen, and obviously you've wanted to follow her there, and let's say you were just like, you know what, I want to move somewhere, and you didn't necessarily have the time factor where she's moving and then you had to go back and forth, would you have done this, the winding down first before you would make the move, yes? So you didn't have to have the back and forth?
Yeah, if I had had the opportunity, I probably would have attempted to do the winding down first. Unfortunately, that just wasn't possible with the way that my wife's job worked out. It ended up being a very fast offer and acceptance. She was offered the job she found out the job was available in March. She applied for it, I think, March 30th, had an interview on April 10th via phone, had the interview in person April 21st, was offered the job on April 23rd, and had to start May 9th.
Right.
So, unfortunately, you know, if time had allowed for it, I would have preferred to be able to do a more gradual wind down and do a more gradual open, to be able to kind of have more of a clean break, because the travel has been expensive. I mean, even though there's been lots of benefits that have been earned from it, the travel itself is taking a real big bite out of my profit margin for this coming year. You know, for tax year 2016, I'm probably going to have an extra $30,000 of expenses that I didn't plan on at the beginning of the year. Yep. And that's just in airline travel and expenses related to that.
Yep. And would you also, is starting a new practice from scratch in a new city? I mean, that I can only imagine attorneys that might be considering moving, and you know, and certainly what ties them to a specific city, even if maybe they don't really want to live there, maybe they live there longer than they maybe would have, is because, you know, they need to make a living, and they've got their practice, and they've got all these people they're working with, you know, and you've made the jump of starting a practice from scratch in a new city. Is there anything else that you can you know, first of all, did you get the office right away? I mean, obviously you've worked with us. I mean, maybe you can talk about, you know, working with lead generation programs for maybe there's been a lot of attorneys that didn't have leads coming in their practice, or maybe they relied on that to a certain degree, but then obviously you've been able to just turn on leads from us in a different city. That's, I'm assuming, helping you jumpstart things. But is there anything else that has been really helpful for you? Or maybe can you talk about how that's helped for you to make that transition into an entirely new city, an entirely new environment, and also getting familiar with the courts and so forth?
Biggest piece of advice I can give you is, as soon as you can, go find the district judges who are doing the stuff you want to do. Here's the other thing to talk. Start with the district judges. Go to the courthouse and either go and sit in the gallery for a day, or jump court to court to court so that you actually get to see the judges practice. Believe me, they will notice that, you know, go wear your proper attorney suit, wear something that makes you look like you're supposed to be there, because the judges will, once they're done with their normal stuff, they will look at the bench and look in the gallery, and they will ask, what is your business here? At that point, go up and introduce yourself. You go, you talk to the judges, you say, Your Honor, I'm new here. I'm in the process of moving my practice from wherever I am to wherever you're going. You know, I'm trying to get a feel for your court. I'm trying to get a feel for how things run. I want to know basically how things are done here so that I don't put my foot in my mouth on day one when I show up thinking I know what I'm doing, when I really don't. A little bit of humility and humbleness goes an incredibly long way with the judges. The judges in Ellis County have been incredibly gracious to me, both the district court judges and the county court judges. They said, basically, anything you need, come see us. The judges in Kaufman County, same thing. Basically, you walk in the door, you say, Your Honor, I'm new. You know, I've been practicing in El Paso, but this is not El Paso. This is, you know, this is your house. What do I need to do to be welcome? You know, the judges, they not only respect that, they appreciate it in ways that are hard to describe, because they realize that you're not just walking in thinking you know everything. They realize that you're coming in and you're asking, what is the appropriate thing to do here versus anywhere else I happen to be? The second thing would be, after talking to the judges, go to the Council of Judges administration. So whoever the administrator is who's handling the court dockets, appointments, division of cases, criminal appointments, any sort of background stuff. I mean, just the kind of mechanical stuff that happens in the background that normally people don't pay attention to. It's always good to know what that is, even if you don't pay attention to it after you get settled and get started again. Knowing how the system works and knowing who to talk to when there's a problem will save you an immense amount of grief later on when something goes wrong, because something invariably will go wrong eventually. Either a filing will get lost, or a deadline will get missed, or you know, the dog will eat a filing that you needed to take with you to the courthouse to be filed with the county clerk in person because they don't happen to accept terminations and adoptions via online. They just accept them in paper because of the sensitive nature of the document. Being able to know that before you try to file it online and have it rejected is an incredible benefit. The other side of that is similarly true. El Paso does not allow you to file terminations and adoption paperwork online. They just don't. If you want to file something of that nature, you have to go, well, you can file the first document online, but after that, your answer has to be in paper format. All of your motions have to be in paper format. All of your discovery, all of your child protective services or child review from third party individuals from the domestic relations office have to be in paper format. You can't file anything through the e-file system anymore for El Paso. I got to Kaufman County, the first thing I did was go and speak to the district clerk and said, what can I file online and what do I have to file on paper? And they looked at me and said, you file everything online. I said, okay, that's a change. That's something different than what I'm used to. And I'm glad I know that, because now it means I'm not just walking up with a stack of papers, you know, three reams of paper tall. So you're not trying to file 1,500 pages of documents and saying, well, yeah, I need a certified copy now. So, nope, you walk in, you do it all online, and you deliver it. They deliver it to the judges themselves. So you can do, you know, in Kaufman County, you can do a proposed order online. You can do a home study that's in an adoption determination online, and they're fine with that versus, like I said, El Paso, which requires those things to be in paper format rather than digital format. So, right. Like I said, the second thing is going and talking to the staff. I mean, the Council of Judges staff, the individuals who do the appointments, the individuals who determine which judge gets a case, because there may be a judge that, for some reason, you're moving into a county that you've done business with before. I mean, that's the other thing to find out is who is the judges or who are the judges that are in that county, because strange things happen. You know, it might be some distant relative that you now need to pay attention to make sure that there isn't a conflict of interest in your practice. You know, go sit down, talk to the judges, talk to them about office space, talk to them about their history, talk to them about what is important to them, what is not important to them. Pay attention to what the other attorneys who practice before them do or don't do. Just as an example, one of the judges in one of the county courts in El Paso is a real stickler about where the parties sit. The petitioner always sits on the right, the defendant always sits on the left. State always sits on the right from the judge. The defendant always sits on the left, because that happens to be the way the courtroom is laid out, is the jury box is to the right of the judge. And the judge always says, okay, the prosecution is supposed to sit next to the jury box. The plaintiff in a civil action is always supposed to sit nearest to the jury box, because they're the ones who have the burden.
Right, so there's all these local rules and nuances and procedures and things that you need to really get familiar with, so you're not looking. So first of all, you know how to proceed and how to do things properly, but also to make sure you're not, you know, perturbing any of the judges or anyone in there that is used to doing things a certain way, and then you're doing something differently.
Right, and that was going to be my third thing, is go find a copy of the local rules for the county. Every county in Texas has one. Basically, you go in, you find the local rules, and they'll have stuff like standing orders in divorces, you know, don't disturb the other party, don't take the kids out of school, don't change their residence without permission of the court, don't harass or threaten the other party. Those are the general ones, but each county has their own tweaks on it. You know, what supervised visitation looks like, visitation will be granted between the parties if there's not some reason not to do it. How long temporary orders will be. The Kaufman County standing orders say that temporary orders hearings are a half hour. That's it, total. So you get 15 minutes, the other party gets 15 minutes for temporary orders while you're getting stuff prepped. If you need to go longer than that, you need to play Mother May I with the judge. You have to go and say, Your Honor, there's X, Y, and Z circumstance, which requires more time. But that's an important thing to know, so you don't prep an hour-long or two-hour-long temporary orders hearing and then have the judge tell you, you have 15 minutes, and then, you know, have to scramble through one-tenth of what you had prepared.
Right, exactly. Okay, so, you know, and I really appreciate you shining a light for those, you know, on all these different, not only the strategies, but also how to, you know, move to a new city, get familiar with the courts, the judge. I mean, these are all really applicable tips, especially for someone that's new to a local court or maybe just starting to practice law in a new county. I mean, these are the pitfalls that you're helping people avoid here. So that's really key. But I do want to be respectful of your time. And certainly, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this final question, and maybe we can wrap up, is, you know, over the years that we've been working together, you've always been one of the highest converting attorneys in our network. And so is there anything specific about calling, responding to, and consulting with leads that you've learned over the years, or just strategies that you can shine a light on, even just for a couple minutes, about just the initial process. You get the lead. How do you respond to it? What's the goal on the initial call? Just those best practices that you've developed and even refined maybe over the years to really be as effective as possible at calling and converting that lead.
Well, as I started out with this one, this actually kind of wraps around to where I started. The fact that I don't have a staff, it's just me, allows me a certain amount of freedom to, and a certain amount of responsibility to look at what I've got directly. So I have actually a separate email account. I have my own email domain, and I would suggest to any attorney, don't use a Google address, don't use a Yahoo address, don't do a Hotmail address. Go to GoDaddy, buy a domain. It's cheap. It's like $300 for 5 years, and you get an email address with it. You get like 5 email addresses with it, in fact. Set up one of those emails for Unbundled Attorney to drop in. I actually have one of my email addresses is information@charlesskinnerlaw.com. Any case that comes in as a referral from Unbundled Attorney drops into that email box. In addition, because I have I practice law via my cell phone, that's my only phone line. I also get all of my emails through my smartphone. I have an Apple iPhone 5. It reads all my email. And when I get an email from Unbundled Attorney, it gives me the option basically to pop up and say, you've received a lead, and the phone number is right on it. So I can look at it, go, I have a lead, click the phone number and call them back immediately. If I'm in the middle of doing something, you can sometimes send them a text. You may attempt to send them a text message saying, thank you for, you know, contacting Unbundled Attorney. I've received your email. May I call you at X time if you can't speak immediately? Also, what I've noticed is because of the particular counties that I've practiced in, about maybe a quarter of my clients actually call me. So as soon as they click the send button asking for an attorney referral, I get their email, but they also get the separate email. And what they've been doing is they've been picking up the phone and calling me and saying, you know, okay, I need a consultation. What's involved in this? What do I need to do? Who do I need to talk to? You know, are you the attorney? Yes, I am he. How may I help you? And then what I'll do is, if I'm close enough to my computer, I'll sit down, I'll pull up my email and look at the little blurbs they've sent me as to what their legal issue is, or at least what they think their legal issue is, and be able to talk to them intelligently about it. If I don't happen to be there, you know, I'll say, okay, you know, your name is X, you know, write it down. I'll usually do, if I'm not in the middle of doing something else right then, do the phone consultation right then and there. That's incredibly valuable to people, believe it or not. Being able to give them a bit of peace of mind right then and there will often turn a potential client into a retained client. You know, not just somebody who wants to say, you know, I need a divorce. What do I do to write it myself? No, you need a divorce. Let's talk about what those issues are and what they look like. And this is roughly what I think it's going to cost, because that will give them a certain level of security. It's kind of like a warm security blanket at that point. Hey, wait a minute. I am talking to somebody. I'm making progress. Not just, hey, I'm going to have a call in a couple of days. That person may or may not call you back as an attorney. You know, they may be booked. Who knows? But being able to take, even if it's 10 minutes of time, to address two or three of their big issues right then and there goes an incredibly long way toward giving the potential client a little bit of peace of mind, and means that even if they don't hire you right then and there, they're at least going to call you back, because they're going to say, okay, I spoke to this person. They gave me some peace of mind. And they may say, well, listen, you know, go get a second opinion. Talk to a couple of other attorneys. See what they're going to quote you. See what they're going to talk to you about. But make sure that if you do talk to them, you talk to them about X, Y, and Z, because that's going to be important to your case. The minute you give a piece of information or a piece of advice like that to a potential client, they will call you back. almost guaranteed, because they feel you are looking out for them even when they are not your client yet.
Yeah, we had a lot of attorneys that talk about, you know, just wherever the client is at, even if whatever their circumstances are, financial, what otherwise, just making sure that that client is in a better position no matter what happens on that call, whether they're going to be retaining you or not, whether they have a pathway or not, but giving them some guidance and making sure that that's a commitment that they're bringing to that call, so that, you know, that person's going to be in a position to make a better decision and, you know, move forward, make progress, like you said, as a result of that contact they had with you. All right. Well, hey, I think this is a great place to wrap it up, Charles. I just want to first thank you for taking the time and sharing so many great tips and strategies. I mean, I was taking notes all throughout. We've got a couple strong pages, a lot of which, you know, this is the first time we've heard some of these strategies and tips and suggestions. So I really just appreciate your willingness to share and give strategies and ideas and that attorneys can apply and into their practice right away. So thanks so much for your time and for your generosity. And we certainly appreciate all the work you're doing for the clients, and looking forward to continue to support you with getting your practice ramped up in the Dallas area and the new area you're living in. So thanks again.
Glad to be of help. Glad to work with you guys. And I look forward to a continued long and prosperous relationship.
Indeed. Okay. So with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up. So thanks for everyone that's listening to the podcast. We certainly appreciate your participation. Hope you enjoyed the show. And for anyone else that if you know anyone else that may be benefiting from this show, feel free to share the episodes, as we certainly appreciate that and furthers the mission of helping more attorneys work with more clients, grow their practice, and also make a difference in offering affordable and unbundled options in their practice. So thanks again for listening, and we'll see you all on the next episode.
For more information about how our lead generation services can help you grow your practice, visit our website at www.unbundledattorney.com. And if you're enjoying this podcast, please be sure to subscribe so you get each new episode as soon as it's available, and leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. Once again, thanks for listening.